What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Our guests today are Jack Norton, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice at Governor State University, and Judah Schept, Professor in the School of Justice Studies at Eastern Kentucky University. Their book that they co-edited along with Lydia Pillow Hobbs, Assistant Professor of Geography and African American and Africana Studies at the University of Kentucky, is The Jail is Everywhere, Fighting the New Geography of Mass Incarceration. Thank you both for joining us today. Jack, I'll start with you, and then Judy, you can weigh in. And I usually don't ask this question until later in the interview, but I want to start with the title, The Jail is Everywhere. Say more about that.
Thanks, Kat, and thanks for having us on today. The title, The Jail is Everywhere, I guess it has to do with this finding. So I'll introduce myself. Thanks for the introduction. I'm an assistant professor at Governor State University outside of Chicago. But before I had that job, I worked for 5 years for the Vera Institute as a researcher. And my job was to go around to different counties around the country and investigate rising jail incarceration, especially in rural communities. Because basically, like, jail incarceration has been rising the last 20 years in rural counties and small cities. And that was a surprising finding, because before that, most people consider mass incarceration to be centered, or had considered it to be centered, in big cities, neighborhoods like in Brooklyn or Harlem, or in places like LA, or just big cities. That's what we think about mass incarceration. We think about people going to jail in big cities. And in fact, jail incarceration has been rising mostly in small counties, small cities, and some of these rural counties that nobody has ever heard of. So the title, The Jail is Everywhere, partly is just talking about, like, there are over 3,000 counties in the United States. Most of them have county jails, and jail incarceration is really everywhere. Jail capacity is everywhere in the country.
Thank you for that. Judah, is there anything that you would like to add?
I think the only thing I would add there is that, you know, Jack and Lydia and myself have been active in a lot of different ways around challenging mass incarceration for a while. And for much of the history of the sort of anti-prison industrial complex movement, the focus has very understandably been on challenging state prisons and mass incarceration as located in prisons, because numerically that is where the largest concentration of incarcerated folks reside. But to Jack's point, that there has been, even as some states have stopped building out prisons and in fact have started closing some prisons, there's been a related rise and reliance on jails. And so we all sort of have come to realize that through sort of different paths, and figured it was time to really sort of focus our efforts on identifying the fact that the jail has become, or has kind of reoriented itself as, the locus of mass incarceration. And we wanted to draw attention to that, and the fact that there are organizers all around the country in all kinds of places who are fighting it.
I'm going to stay with you, Judah, because that's actually where I wanted to go next, because one of the things that struck me as I was going through the book was, and as someone that talks about this issue a lot, is that I think that people have generally assumed or believed that decarceration was happening, that we were walking away from mass incarceration. Can you talk about, though, that the specific dynamics at play that devolve decarceration into just funneling people into a different kind of cage?
I mean, I think you said it best with the word you just used there, which is devolve. I think a lot of what's happened is there have been efforts around the country in the majority of states to reduce state prison populations. This looks differently in different states, and some have done it better than others. What a focus only at the scale of the state prison can mask or preclude is a recognition that it hasn't actually led to much, if any, decarceration, but in fact has led to this idea of devolution, which is simply a reorganization of incarcerated people and incarceration capacities at just a lower level scale of the state, which is the county or city jail. And so that's a huge part of our motivation as editors of this book, is to try and draw our attention both downscale at the level of the jail, but always also across scales, because the county jail is not only this sort of local or provincial site of carceral infrastructure, but it's attached in really concrete, material ways to both state governments and the federal government. And so it's really important to both like sort of look locally at these county jails and city jails and identify kind of context specific forces that are at work, and of course always look and try and sort of track and map the ways that they're connected at these other scales as well.
Jack, anything that you would like to add to that?
No, I think Judith said it really well. I guess I would, and you said it well too with devolve, like Judith pointed out. I guess I would give an example of Indiana, for example. Like the state of Indiana is one of the centers of mass incarceration in the United States right now. A lot of prison incarceration and really a lot of rising jail incarceration. So Indiana, the state, when Mike Pence was governor, for example, back in, I think, 2015, they did the so-called, you know, bipartisan prison reform because they wanted to get their prison incarceration numbers down, really, to show that, you know, they reformed prisons. And so what they did is they devolved incarceration down to the county jail level. So this sounds wonky, but I feel like it's a good example of how this works and why it matters, because they made it so certain drug felonies, like class D or class C felonies, if you got arrested for one of those and you were sentenced, say, to a couple of years in prison, you would do that time at the county jail. So, and it sounds crazy, but it's like all of a sudden they had all of these people getting arrested for drugs who were now going to go into the county jail and do their time. And the people reforming said, you know, this is so that people can spend time closer to their families, et cetera, et cetera. But in reality, it just meant that, okay, the prison numbers went down a little bit. So they could say, okay, we brought the prison numbers down. But then all of a sudden, there's so much pressure on the counties to have all of these people in jail, right? And so then county after county after county in Indiana started predictably to have to, or I mean, they, yeah, basically to have to build bigger jails. So you had a situation in the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years where almost every county in Indiana is building a massive new jail that is basically a sort of, you know, state prison system in a sense. So it's really wonky, and there's like a shell game that is going on, you know, where it's like you got a ball and there's three shells and you got to follow the ball. It's like that is going on. But the result of that sort of reform is that the actual capacity to put people in cages in Indiana has increased by quite a bit, right? Whether that capacity is increasing at the county level or the state level, the total capacity is really increased. So,
and we're going to talk a little bit about the co-optation of reform language to increase the amount of incarceration that we're seeing. I want to be fair. I got the word devolved from y'all's book. That was not me being smart. So listeners should know that. And one more thing about language. You use the term jail booster in the book. What does that mean, Judah?
A jail booster is really anyone or any, let's say, community official or body who is pursuing jail expansion or jail construction. I think we probably use that term because in different places, that can look like different individuals. That certainly can be like a sheriff's office or the official of the sheriff in a given county. It can look like a, let's say, like a county commissioner or a group of county commissioners or county council people. It can look like other politicians. It certainly could include construction companies or attorneys. It could look like citizens in a county who are part of, you know, a given city or county's political or civic leadership who stand to politically or financially benefit from jail construction. So I think we chose to use that term to try and capture the breadth and diversity of folks who might be on the side of jail expansion and construction.
I'm glad that you brought up citizens, because one of the things that we're seeing, right, in the backlash to the defund movement, the backlash to Black Lives Matter, are these groups of citizens, political actors that are clamoring for an increase in incarceration and investment into the carceral state, and have really been shifting the political conversation to even in progressive cities like where I live in Oakland, California. And we're watching politicians kowtow to the fear-mongering that is happening right now to justify mass incarceration. You can respond to that or not. I want to focus on sheriffs. I live in Alameda County. We've got one of the deadliest county jails in the country. I think upwards of now 70 murders or deaths inside since 2014. Can you talk about the way, Jack, sheriffs have led campaigns to justify jail expansion?
Sure. Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up. Sheriffs are a super important part. Just, I'm sure your listeners know this, but I'll just say it. Basically, a sheriff, jails are run by sheriff's offices, right? A sheriff is like the top law enforcement person in a county. There are over 3,000 counties in the U.S., so there are a lot of sheriffs in the U.S., and it's an elected position, and each of them run the county jail. So, I mean, I could go on and on about how the sheriffs are involved in jail expansion. I mean, at a basic level, it's like sheriffs want to expand the jails usually because it just means an increase in their budget. You know, it's just like it's politics. They want to increase the size of the office that they run. And you know, I know Judah can speak more to this, but I'll just bring it up. Like, sheriffs can fight for expanded jails under a number of guises, excuses, right? You can have like law and order sheriffs, like I've seen in like Alamance County, North Carolina, you know, saying, oh, we need to expand the jail because you know, they resort to like racist fear mongering about the Sinaloa cartel, for example. You can have progressive sheriffs saying that they need to expand the jail for so-called progressive reasons, right? They need more treatment programs in the jail, whatever. But the fact is, in general, a sheriff is going to try to expand the facilities that they're in control of and expand their budgets.
I mean, I've got some follow-up questions, but Judah, what would you like to insert here?
I think maybe the only detail I would add to that, Jack is really an expert on this. The only details I would add come from a couple of the chapters in our book. In one, Xochitl Bervera and Wes Ware talk about efforts against an expansion of the Atlanta jail. And they had their organization had the agreement from the mayor's office at the time to not expand the jail and to work towards downsizing it. And it was, in fact, the sheriff for Fulton County, the county in which Atlanta is located, who, through sort of various mechanisms, was actually able to kind of convince the mayor that the county would lease beds from the city. So there you have the mayor of the city and the sheriff of the county, so, you know, sort of collaborating and going against the expressed kind of commitment of the mayor's office to these organizers to close the jail, and in fact doing just the opposite and not closing it, and in fact attempting to expand it. And then the other detail I just wanted to mention, sheriffs, and this is detailed in particular in a chapter written by Silky Shah, who works with an organization called Detention Watch Network. Sheriffs can collaborate directly with ICE and lease out their beds for immigrant detention. she has a phrase in her chapter. I think she calls it, I don't have it in front of me. She says something like county jails are like the backbone of the immigrant detention system. And so sheriffs are, of course, sort of like looking down, if you will, at their county, but they are also looking up to an agency like ICE to try and keep their jails open, increase their revenue, increase the number of people incarcerated, and potentially build out their own capacity.
You are listening to Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Jack Norton and Judah Shept about their book that they edited with Lydia Palo Hobbs called The Jail is Everywhere, Fighting the New Geography of Mass Incarceration. Jack, you used two words in a sentence together that I don't know that I would, and that is progressive sheriffs. that said, you know, the co-optation of progressive causes per se to justify jail expansion, that this is where people get mental health services, this is where people can get substance abuse treatment. We're seeing that argument in San Francisco. We'll go into detail in a little bit later. But talk about the ways in which, as you assert early in the book, that jail incarceration actually impoverishes community and actually negatively impacts health.
Okay. The progressive sheriffs, yeah, we'll get to that later. But jail impoverishes communities. I mean, the sheriff's budget, is often one of the biggest areas of spending in a community. So there is a simple fact that, like, so much investment in jails and in communities, and I'm thinking particularly of rural communities, kind of like the rural community I grew up in, the county that I grew up in upstate New York. It's like there's all of this investment in a jail. So like when a county like that builds a new jail, they're usually taking on a 20, 30 year lease, right? So they're going to be paying on, not a lease, I'm sorry, a bond issue, right? So they're going into debt to build this massive jail. That's precluding investment in the county and other areas, like in health, education, things like that. So jail investment comes at the expense of what could be in places like this. And I mean, if you don't mind me telling a little story, like this was really brought home to me when during the pandemic, I was living in New York City, and I went back to where I'm from, just because I have health issues, and I was scared during the pandemic. So I was up there in Washington County, New York, where I'm from, rural county. And there's a hospital on the hill there where most of my family was born, and it had been closed down since 2003, right? So it was like in a pandemic, looking at a closed hospital. And 2003 was also the year that the county where I'm from built a new jail in the county that was at least three times the capacity of the old jail. So yeah, all of this investment in jails in rural counties and everywhere comes at the expense of what else could be in a county. And this is really important, especially in place rural areas that are seeing hospital closures and other forms of real disinvestment that impacts people's lives negatively.
Judah, anything that you would like to add there?
I just think it's such an acute point that Jack is making, that these are political choices that are being made at the county level. There is no inherent need for a jail to exist or to expand. And so when counties bond out, they're making a decision for the next 30 years and potentially even beyond about the priorities, the spending and social priorities of that given county or city. And it could be completely different than that. So they do take up, you know, huge chunks of like a county budget and whatnot. They reflect these kinds of spending political decisions. And crucially, that's a point of leverage for people who are opposed to this, who believe that our tax dollars and political priorities should go elsewhere. It doesn't have to be this way.
Right. I mean, that's the whole premise of defund, right? That all of the things that communities want money for, all of the things that make communities safer, that money is tied up in funding the carceral state, which is clearly a failed strategy for public safety. Where do I want to go next? You've talked a little bit about geography. Can you talk about the difference in the expansion we are seeing in rural areas versus big cities, and what are the factors that impact that difference?
There are now, this is a relatively recent development, more people incarcerated in rural jails in the United States, and there are more people going to jail at higher rates in rural communities than in urban communities. So there is a shifting geography of mass incarceration, both downscale from prisons to the jail, as we've been talking about, but also in the rural communities that Jack was just discussing, including the one that he grew up in. These have become the places with the highest rates of incarceration, and slowly but surely also the places with just like numerically the larger numbers of people. So just to give you like a concrete example, from my region, I live in Lexington, Kentucky, and some of my work has been in Eastern Kentucky and Central Appalachia. And every jail out there, whether we're talking about a county jail or one of these, what are called regional jails, which service multiple counties, every single one of them is at minimum at 140 or 150% capacity. And some of them are at over 200% capacity. And these are the jails that have just seen, you know, remarkably growing rates of incarceration over the last maybe 10 to 15 years. And it reflects, I mean, in some ways, it reflects some of the same patterns that we're used to talking about when it comes to cities. Divestment from the state, departure of capital, structural unemployment. Those are the same sorts of motivating factors that lead to criminalization on the one hand, and also the expansion of the state through its carceral capacities on the other.
Jack, anything you'd like to add there?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I don't want to pretend that I know all of the answer to that, but I will point out that there's so many rural counties, right? And almost every one of them has a jail. And so when we're talking about like a quiet jail boom, we talk about that in the intro, and Jasmine Heiss has a chapter in the book called A Quiet Jail Boom. And the reason that jail boom is so quiet is it's happening in rural areas. And we're talking about thousands of counties with small jails. And, you know, there are just a lot of counties that we've never heard of or thought about in the United States, right? And they have these small jails. And so when you're talking about, oh, what was a 12-bed jail being expanded to a 100-bed jail, right? It doesn't seem like that big of a deal necessarily. You know, from my point, it's like, oh, some county in Indiana I haven't heard of, they expanded their jail from a 12-bed to a 100 or 200-bed jail. But when that happens in 1,000 different places, that's just a massive expansion of capacity to lock people up in this country. So it doesn't answer your question, but I just think it's a good point where it's like, it's a quiet boom. It's a diffuse sort of decentralized thing that has been happening for 20 years. And it can just be hard to get a handle on or to know what's happening. And it can be hard to really understand if you're in a county like that, that your county expanding its jail like this, you know, is a big deal or is part of a massive expansion in the United States. If you follow me, it can almost just seem like my county that I grew up in, right? When they expand their jail in 2003 or whatever, you know, I don't think, you know, 20, 22, 23-year-old me was thinking, oh, well, that's part of a massive jail expansion that's happening in the United States, right? I was probably thinking like, you know, my county sucks or whatever. I hate this place. Of course they did that, you know? And so it can just seem in a rural area that it's like disconnected from that trend. So that's the point I want to make, and that's what I hope this book can help do for people, because there are a lot of people in rural areas fighting jail expansion, and I think it's important to point out that those fights are can be sort of like the central abolitionist fight against mass incarceration in a lot of cases.
Thank you for that. I want to move on to this idea of narrative and language and the co-optation of it by the state in order to justify jail expansion. So here in California, our governor has put forth a proposal to turn San Quentin, which is one of the state's oldest and most violent, notoriously violent prisons, into a place focused on so-called rehabilitation for a select group of prisoners. This is his response to the demand to decarcerate. Can you talk about the concept of carceral humanism and how this played out with another California governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger? Judah.
Sure. Yeah, and carceral humanism in some ways is a newish name for something that has been done for about as long as we've had incarceration, which is to argue for it as a form of rehabilitation or more recently concepts like therapeutic justice. And in the case of our book and some of the cases that that our authors talk about, even so far as like the jail as a site of racial justice or of the provision of racial justice or social justice. So carceral humanism is a concept that was coined by the scholar and activist James Kilgore to try and reckon with what was going on in his county in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. I encountered it directly as an organizer and an author in the small city I was living in Indiana 15 years ago in Bloomington. And as you said, it describes essentially the process of trying to expand some kind of carceral infrastructure, sometimes prisons, often jails, through appeals to their ability or their supposed putative ability to provide treatment, counseling, rehabilitation, social services, welfare, poverty alleviation, and social justice to very marginalized residents. It can be difficult for organizers to engage with this because it's, at least for those of us who have been doing this work for a while, it marks a pretty distinct, at least rhetorical departure from a focus on much more like full-throated law and order, lock everybody up politics. And it can kind of capture well-meaning, it can capture or in fact be expressed by and advocated by, you know, really well-meaning county and city officials who care about their populations and have seen their revenues decline and are unable to provide social services in the way that they might like. And they increasingly, and this is occurring in many, many places around the country, increasingly are looking to their jail as the source to provide these kinds of services. And so it's really a crucial question of the moment for people opposed to mass incarceration to kind of to reckon with this attempt at kind of co-opting and capturing our efforts to oppose incarceration and to be really principled in our opposition, even as, you know, lots of like one of the central lessons of the book is people kind of building out these coalitions with other folks. And so it's this kind of important flexibility folks have to have, I think, between building out coalitions, including with people with whom you might not have, you know, various kinds of political alignment or agreement, and at the same time, potentially opposing people with whom you do have some amount of political agreement or alignment, but who have been kind of integrated into a carceral humanist attempt at jail expansion.
You are listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Jack Norton and Judah Schept about their book that they edited with Lydia Pillow-Hobbs, The Jail is Everywhere, Fighting the New Geography of Mass Incarceration. I want to move on. You touched on this earlier, but to talk a little bit about the different utilization of jails, can you say more about the ways in which ICE is using jails and when this phenomenon began? Jack?
Sure. That's a great question. Man, I don't know when the phenomenon began with ICE, but I can talk about how they're using jails. So basically ICE or the U.S. Marshals, so we'll say federal agencies, and I'll explain why that's important in a minute. So the two federal agencies that use county jails are ICE and the U.S. Marshal Service, USMS. And basically, ICE and the Marshals use county jails as sort of like a flexible detention capacity in the United States. And And the reason I call it a flexible detention capacity is because they can kind of, they encourage counties to build bigger jails. And the way they encourage counties to build bigger jails is they say, well, if you build a bigger jail, we'll rent out extra beds. We'll pay per diem amounts. So if ICE, say a county in Iowa builds a big jail with extra beds, ICE will pay that county X dollars per diem, per day, that they have an ICE detainee, that they lock somebody up there for ICE. And that can be a significant source of revenue for a county. And to get back to your question about geography, especially for a rural county, that can really matter. That money can really add up. So I know it's a little wonky, but the money works where it's like if a county, a rural county is going to fix their jail or build a slightly bigger jail anyway, and they can say, oh, we're going to get this revenue stream in from ICE or the U.S. Marshals. That can be a sort of cudgel that the sheriff uses politically to be like, we have to build a much bigger jail. It's going to give us a source of revenue. So over the years, ICE and the U.S. Marshals have encouraged counties to really expand their jail system so that ICE can use that, can rent those beds out. Now, that doesn't mean the county is guaranteed a revenue stream from ICE. And in fact, many counties can sort of build up their jails and then find that, you know, so for example, like Albany County, New York, they had a big jail. They detained people for ICE. And then politically, during the Trump administration, there was some opposition to doing that. So ICE can just say like, okay, well, we'll just use the jail in the next county over, right? So it's a massive capacity that's been built up at the county level, and it's a flexible capacity for these federal agencies, meaning, you know, if your county isn't down with it, we'll just deal with the next county over who's also built a big jail.
Thank you for that. I'm clocking the time, and we've spent a lot of time talking about the problems of jail expansion. I'd like to spend a little bit of time doing the other thing you do in the book, which is talk about resistance movement. Judah, can you talk about the In Our Backyards initiative?
I might, if it's okay, Kat, I might defer to Jack to the In Our Backyards, because that's the project that he was a part of at the Vera Institute.
Oh, sure. The In Our Backyards initiative is no longer exists. It was an initiative at the Vera Institute of Justice where I worked. I was hired as part of the initiative. And basically, you know, when the Vera Institute, a guy named Jacob Pang Brown, a researcher at the Vera Institute, is the guy that I would credit for sort of figuring out that the jail incarceration rates were growing in rural areas and small cities. And the In Our Backyards initiative was a research and outreach initiative that sort of looked into what was going on in different counties. So I was a researcher there. My colleague Jasmine Heiss was sort of led the advocacy there. And so it was an initiative. We worked with resistance groups in different parts of the country, that sort of thing. And we also investigated rising jail incarceration rates across the country.
Thank you for that. There's also a chapter that lifts up a group that my organization, Anti-Police Terror Project, works with. They're in our backyard. That's Decarcerate Sacramento, who've been for a hot minute now fighting jail expansion in Sacramento. Can one of you talk about that work, their obstacles and successes that started, a lot of which the fight is rooted in the Mays versus Sacramento lawsuit?
Yeah, that's right. Liz Blum is the author of that chapter. I mean, all of these chapters are so crucial. Liz's chapter is really incredible because it gets at several themes really concretely that you then find again and again in numerous other chapters. One of which, I mean, we talked about it a little bit already, this the sort of role of carceral humanism, but to be a little bit more concrete about it, Liz lays out the Mays lawsuit and other attempts at resolving or addressing really horrific conditions of the Sacramento jail through legal means, which can sound really crucial for those of us who care about people who are locked up, who have loved ones who are locked up, of course we want them to be held, if they have to be held inside, to be held in conditions that reflect, you know, basic standards of human decency and human rights as a minimum, right? The problem that Liz and her comrades found, and that other folks who author chapters in the books found, is that these so-called conditions of confinement lawsuits, time and again, can actually sort of underwrite the credibility of jail construction or expansion campaigns. People can look at these lawsuits or look at the threat of a consent decree and say, you know, these conditions are horrific. We have to avoid a lawsuit, or we have to address, you know, these conditions that have been applied to us by the federal government. And to do so, we have to expand our jail. And so that's sort of what Liz and Decarcerate Sacramento encountered. And they did some incredible organizing, right? They talked to local officials. They organized on the ground. They door knocked. They did huge amounts of political education. All of these sorts of components of a successful anti-jail campaign. So we really are indebted to Liz for laying out. And I guess I should also say the other thing that Liz does in that chapter is speak to sort of the what can be a really wonky financing system of jails and prisons using bonds. And she does it in a way that's really concrete and intelligible. And yeah, it's just a crucial chapter.
Agreed. There's also a chapter about how the rise of the opioid epidemic in Appalachia has given rise to jail expansion, or as they call it, cages in the coal fields. Which of you would like to talk about the work happening there?
I think we can both talk about it. Both Jack and I have some substantial engagement with work in the coal fields in central Appalachia generally, and in eastern Kentucky specifically. The chapter you're referencing is written by our friend and colleague and comrade, Amelia Kirby, who is really instrumental, I mean, really like foundational to bringing to kind of national attention the problems of mass incarceration in that region. A lot of what's happened is that with the decline and departure of the coal industry, there's been a complete decline of coal employment, but also a once reliable revenue stream that had been attached to coal extraction. And with the declines of both, prisons and jails have become kind of like the sources for communities to imagine anything and everything from new sources of employment to mechanisms to keep people from moving out to like very basic needs of counties at the level of like municipal infrastructure, like extending water lines and renovating wastewater treatment, right? So like the prisons and the jails in that region become very materially attached to people's abilities to reproduce themselves in those areas, and counties' abilities to like make basic infrastructure work. And I think it provides like a particularly thorny but urgent opportunity for abolitionists and others opposed to jails and prisons to really imagine what a different kind of education system and infrastructure and whatnot can look like in those places.
Jack, what would you like to add there?
I'll add to that. It's like, yeah, Amelia Kirby's chapter. I really love this chapter, and I really have learned so much from Amelia Kirby, both in the process of this book and working with Amelia in Kentucky over the years. But one thing about Kentucky, to go back to the devolved evolution thing, and I know this is wonky, but I think this is important, because I was talking about like, oh, progressive sheriffs or whatever, but it's like Kentucky is one of those states where state prisoners, so people sentenced to do state time, like Class D, Class C felonies, and those are like drug charges, right? Like those people generally do their time in county jails. So let's say if I get arrested for possession of some pills in Kentucky and I get sentenced to 2 years, I'm going to have to do that time in a county jail. And the state of Kentucky is going to pay that county jail a per diem while I'm in that jail. You know what I'm saying? So state jails in Kentucky, and I feel like I want to say this because it's like, it's easy to be like, oh, you know, like sheriffs are bad and all that. And it's like, yes, but it makes sense. It made sense for a lot of counties to be like, all right, we got to build a jail or whatever. Like, you know, the sheriff's pushing for a new jail or whoever's pushing for a new jail. So they're saying like, okay, let's build a huge jail, basically a prison sized jail. And then we'll use it for all of these like state sentenced people and we'll have a revenue stream. You know what I'm saying? So the county goes into debt for like 20, 30 years, builds a massive jail for I don't know how many millions of dollars. This is hypothetical, but it's happened in counties all over Kentucky. And then, you know, they're getting, they're housing state prisoners. So when Judah's like, oh yeah, all of these jails are over capacity, and like, and they really are over capacity. They're super crowded jails in Kentucky, but the counties are getting revenue from the state to do that too. So you had, like Judah just described, like coal fell off, all of these other revenue streams, tax streams fell off for the counties. And all of a sudden, it's like they really need that money coming in for state, from the state prisoners. So like they really are reliant on that. So all of a sudden, it's like the county jail and this whole, it's like they've invested in a jail, but they've also invested in a whole system of criminalizing people. Right? They've invested in like the fact that if I caught with a couple pills, like I need to get a felony, you know, because like they need that money, because if I just got a misdemeanor, then I would just be incarcerated for the county and they wouldn't get any money. You know what I'm saying? So like there's a bigger problem of criminalization. And one of the chapters in the book, the Free Hearts chapter, with Dawn Harrington and Jacola Lane, they really talk about criminalization, but criminalization is the bigger, is part of this, right? It's like poor people are being criminalized for being poor. Like people with mental health problems are being criminalized for those mental health problems. Like there's just this expanding criminalization. So back to this county in Kentucky, now all of a sudden you've got this like financial political system where it's like, even if you have progressive people who are against this criminalization, like it doesn't make sense for them to like support, for example, like the defelonization of drugs in Kentucky, which needs to happen, right? Like people shouldn't be getting locked up for this. But if you're running a county in rural Kentucky and like, and you lose that revenue stream from the state sentenced people, like you can't pay off the debt from the jail. And so I'm sorry if it's like been too complicated, but I really want to bring that home. It's like this jail expansion, it's an investment in jails, but it's also an investment in this whole political system of violence, of criminalization, of stigmatization. And it's like a real political investment in this kind of stuff that it lasts, it's going to last generations, basically.
Thank you for that. Lots more to discuss here, but we are out of time. I will just ask you both one final question, and that is, and we'll start with you, Judah, your hope for this book in the world in this moment.
Thank you for that, and thank you so much for having us, Kat. I became aware of the problem of jail expansion about 15 years ago or so as an organizer against a massive project of kind of carceral humanist jail expansion in Bloomington, Indiana. You know, a small city in a semi-rural county. And at the time, it felt unwieldy and a bit provincial. We didn't quite know who to talk to. Most kind of abolitionist work was focused on prisons, very understandably. And I think since then, I've thought a lot about what would have been help. We wound up being successful for a number of reasons, but I still think it would have been really helpful to have a collection of stories and analyses of people engaging in similar fights for us to learn with and from, and to feel like we weren't in fact provincial, but actually were one node, let's say, of a much larger geography of both jail expansion and people fighting it. And so part of the motivation, I think, for the book and what I hope people get out of it is just that, like a sense, something to learn with, a kind of political education tool, a sense of solidarity, because these are stories from around the country. And a sense that I think the last line of the book is it's something like, you know, your jail fight matters. Like you're at the center, your little jail fight is actually at the center of mass incarceration. And I think that's part or to a large extent, what I hope the book provides is that sort of sense of support and solidarity and yes, political education as well.
Jack.
Yeah, I would echo that. It's like your jail fight matters, even if it's in a small community. And these struggles over jail incarceration and jail plant and jail expansion, they're struggles over planning, because when they're planning a new jail, that a big new jail, they're planning to lock you up basically to cycle you in and out of that jail. So these fights really matter, and it's all over the country. Yeah.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Our guests today have been Jack Norton, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice at Governor State University, and Judah Shep, Professor in the School of Justice Studies at Eastern Kentucky University. Their book that they co-edited with Lydia Palo Hobbs that we've been discussing today is The Jail is Everywhere, Fighting the New Geography of Mass Incarceration. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you, Kat.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world for all of us to thrive in. That's it for this episode, fam. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programming is funded exclusively by listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. Remember, we all we got.